It please the court. Good morning. My name is Kristen Mulholland, and I represent the appellant Peransky, Bauer, and Peracki, who were the plaintiffs in the district court below. The district court granted the bar plan's motion for summary judgment and denied the summary judgment filed by Peransky and Bauer, and that's what we're appealing today. This case arises from the bar plan's denial of coverage under a professional liability policy that it issued to the law firm. The bar plan continuously insured Peransky, Bauer, and Peracki for 7 years, from the years 2003 through 2010. The incident which gave rise to the claim came during the end of the 2006-2007 policy year. The bar plan renewed the policy on April 15, 2007. But prior to that time, the attorneys were not aware that there was any possibility that a malpractice claim might be made against them.
That's a little hard to take, though, when a lawyer with the firm says to the opponent, it's all my fault, it's not my client's fault, can't you reopen this date? And then subsequent to that, there are efforts made to bring suit where in Alabama to get the deal back on the table. That sounds like awareness of a potential, something that could give rise to a claim.
Well, the statements by Mr. Yannakopoulos, the attorney of the firm who had held on to the contract, was simply a matter of ongoing business, just trying to settle what was going on. This was a long-term contract with several...
It's a contract that didn't get to where it was supposed to go, at least according to the sellers, and a member of the firm says, oh, that's all my fault. That's pretty damning.
But at the time, the attorneys were aware that the contract specified that Ohio law would control any issues involved with the contract. And under Ohio law, there is no requirement for delivery of the contract, of the signed contract, for it to be enforceable.
Right, and that's their argument. That's the firm's argument. But requiring notice to be given of something that could give rise to a claim would suggest, I think, any reasonable lawyer, we may be in trouble on this one.
Well, their understanding at the time was that they were just dealing with a seller who was trying to unlawfully get out of the contract. That's why their client, Mr. Novogroder, pursued a Liz Pendens action in Ohio to enforce the contract, because it was enforceable under Ohio law. The attorney could have put the contract in a file and left it there for a year, and it still would have been enforceable under Ohio law.
But so, the notice requirement to the insurer, the malpractice insurer, is not, you must notify us of what your understanding is of whether you may be liable on something, but it's that you have to give notice of any incident that might give rise to a claim.
And their client and they both did not believe that it would give rise to a claim, because they believed that this was enforceable. In the practice of law, it's a adversarial practice, and we're constantly going back and forth with opposing sides, with opposing interpretations of law and facts. But it would be unreasonable for an attorney to have to give notice of each and every act that he took each and every day.
So only if the insured attorney understands that they may be liable, or they may have committed negligence, do they have to send notice to their carrier? That's crazy.
Well, there should be at least, the policy refers to a reasonable belief that they might be liable. And in the exclusionary language, in the exclusion, it states whether they knew or reasonably should have known of a circumstance which might reasonably be expected.
Yeah, not that they reasonably believe, but whether they knew or reasonably should have known. And that's entirely different.
Well, I believe that the language does state that reasonably should have known, or might reasonably be expected, that there might be a claim. And their expectation was that what had happened was not wrong, that the contract did not have to be immediately delivered to be enforceable. and that the contract was fully enforceable.
What did they do when the Alabama case, the Alabama court took jurisdiction of the case down there?
The case was filed in Alabama on March, I believe it's March 14th or 15th, March 14th. And at that point, they hired Mr. Novogrodo is the one who was being sued in Alabama. They hired counsel in Alabama, and they all said, Alabama has no jurisdiction over this case. The contract was for property in Ohio. Mr. Novogrodo had never set foot in Alabama. He had no contacts with Alabama. And under Alabama's long-arm statutes, there was no jurisdiction in Alabama.
Weren't there several other transactions, though, with the same purchaser and in Ohio?
Yes. All of these, they were Rite Aid drugstores, and all of them were in Ohio.
But who was in Alabama? I forget who was in Alabama. What's the name of the person who was in Alabama?
The seller.
And he had gone to three other sales transactions.
Yes.
With the same process.
With the same process. It was a large corporation, and the office from which the sales were happening was in I believe it was Kentucky or Tennessee. I think it was Kentucky. They were not dealing even with the firm, the seller in Alabama. They were dealing with them out of their Kentucky office. But it was an ongoing series of transactions, some of which concluded even after this transaction. They just backed out of this one contract for whatever reason that they thought was they needed to. But it was this ongoing relationship that these parties had. And the firm never thought that there was going to be any claim, and Mr. Novogrodo never thought that there was going to be any claim.
Well, you know, I can see how the argument might be viable with regard to the email exchange in February 23rd, that the parties thought that this could be something that worked out, that was part of the deal negotiations. When the lawsuit was filed in Alabama in March of 07, according to the briefs, appellants retained, or the Mr. Novogrodo, the client, retained counsel down in Alabama. And counsel in Alabama, as I understand it, assured Mr. Novogrodo, as well as appellants, that there's no way this court is going to take jurisdiction of this case. I've been in private practice more recently than the other judges here on the bench. In my practice, I think it's when you give an opinion to a client, you're pretty circumspect about what that opinion would entail. Do you have any, authority or any other cases where in a similar situation a client was basically banked on the opinion to not provide notice to the insurance carrier? Because, I mean, a reasonable attorney, I think a typical attorney, would say, okay, well, I can't guarantee it. There's always risk. But this is how I see the court may come out. And that's certainly how my opinion's read when I give legal opinions to clients.
No, I'm sorry. I do not have any case law that I can cite on that point. And I see that my time is up for now.
Actually, you can go to the red light, but you're in your rebuttal time.
Okay.
You want to save your time for rebuttal?
I'd like to save some time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Mr. Calamaros.
Morning, judges. Bill Calamaros for the Bar Plan. Greetings from my side of the lake. I just want to say out of the box, when I got this case, my stomach went to the floor because the Kuransky firm is an excellent law firm. These are good lawyers. And I think, as many people probably did, pounded their head and said, why didn't you just call the Bar Plan right then and there? And this would have been classified as a reported claim under the 2006 policy. And maybe I would be defending that firm rather than defending this policy. So my empathy is strong, but I do not believe there's any coverage. And we need to keep in mind that the 2006 policy is not in play here because it's undisputed there was no claim. And so then as in the fundamentals of coverage, you go first to the insuring agreement. And the insuring agreement says that in under A, that where a claim is made and reported, and the acts precede the effective policy date of the policy, which of course is an April renewal, that there will be coverage provided that always such act or omission happens in number two prior to the policy period, provided that the effective date of this policy, now we're there. And then we go to B. Such insured had no basis to believe that such insured had committed such an act or omission. Now, I need to point out that we're not talking about whether there was a claim. We're not talking about whether or not you had knowledge of the potential for a claim. Only whether the insured had had any basis to believe they had committed such an act or omission. The February email is clear that the insured knew they committed the act or omission, regardless of whether they thought they were going to get sued or not. You don't even get into the policy coverage. And under the fundamentals of simple policy interpretation, if you're not inside of the insuring agreement, you never get to the exclusion. So the word reasonable never comes up. So I think, tragically, I spent way too much time cutting this every different way. And I think that then Judge Lee tried to make mine even more simple. But the fundamentals are here is that they were warned time and time again that if you know of facts that could. Now, the word could, if you hire, as Attorney Mulholland said, this is an adversarial game. And Judge Lee, as you pointed out, I can't promise anybody anything. Now, having coming off the Notre Dame game, I see the word Alabama, I get a little bit nervous. Here, the court in Alabama, an ex-Supreme Court judge in Alabama said they're never going to take it. They took it. They not only took it, but they found that way. And then the court in Ohio said, sorry. Well, that's I've stood up here plenty of times and been told I was wrong. So the question is not even whether you would, but if the word could comes in there. And is there a way you could lose this? Well, absolutely. If Alabama law takes over, we're done. But going back to the emails are what take it out of the insuring agreement itself. And I can't do anything about that. There just simply is no coverage here. And because of that, now Judge Lee didn't even get to the full course of rescission. He simply said, it's not covered. I picked up, because again we're at summary judgment, we're at de novo, I picked up everything and carried it again. I do not think there is coverage in the insuring agreement. I think two exclusions apply. I think you have material misrepresentation, which clearly is a fundamental. This is a claims-made policy. This is not an occurrence policy. Prejudice does not come into play. This is a horribly avoidable situation by all they had to do was call. And fundamentally, the bar plans, applications, and warnings say over and over, even this, tell whoever your insurer is right now of any facts you may know that could give rise to a claim.
And at the renewal stage, was that also necessary? You have pointed that out.
Judge, they did point it out in the renewal documents. Was it necessary? I think that one of the things that you have is...
I mean for the insured.
Is it?
To point out, I think you're claiming that when they put in for renewal, they should have said they've got this problem pending.
Right. First off, in the March renewal application, do you know of any facts that could give rise to a claim? Not do you know of any claims... And not do you know of any facts that would give rise to a claim, but do you know of any facts, acts, or omissions that could give rise to a claim?
Well, the renewal included prior acts, didn't it? The 06-07 policy didn't.
Rightly so, but prior acts still need to be reported because there's a condition with regard to prior acts. Prior acts isn't just, and everything else you forgot to tell us about. There's nothing that takes the way, and again, we talk about the agent's letter or the letter. It says prior acts. There is prior acts coverage. It doesn't say unrestricted prior acts coverage. It says prior acts coverage as defined by the policy.
Would now that be prior acts that you have to designate?
It's prior acts that you don't know about the facts that could give rise to the claim. And again, those are the... I'm using the word facts. I could say acts, omissions, conduct. And that's the point, is you run out of those things. I think that the other thing we need to be reminded is that between the March 10 period. In the April 6 renewal, lots of things happened. And they have an express obligation to talk about those things too. But keep in mind that we go back to this fundamental principle. Had they called the bar plan at any time between February 2010 or so and the end of the policy period, they would have, in fact, reported facts that could give rise to a claim, and it would have been covered under the 06 policy. And that's one of the important things to remember here. We never get the 06 policy in play here. It's only the 07 policy.
So a listener would understand that Judge Lee, who granted summary judgment, is different than the Judge Lee who sits here today.
Rightly so.
But no relation that we know of.
Not that I know of. Judge Lee, you may know something that we don't know.
But you mentioned rescission. Did Judge Lee at the district court grant rescission to you?
I think when you read the order, he doesn't. I think he just simply says nothing. But he does talk about...
Your brief on appeal seeks to have rescission ordered, doesn't it?
Well, what I did was just pick it up and say, no, I think you can go with exclusion, but you could also go with rescission.
In order to have rescission, though, you would have to tender the premium.
Well, you see, that's a funny thing, and that's I'm interested in that because counsel cites Dodd. Dodd, they accepted transfer in Dodd, so Dodd's not good law right now. And in my deck action, I offered to refund the premium. Now, I don't think it's necessary to get the result that I seek in the case, in the court's case here. But the question of when you tender back is always something that I guess I hate to sound academically curious, but I am. Is if I'm in a position where I have an ab initio policy, or what I think should be one, shouldn't the court be able to say, I think it's void too, but I choose to make you send the money back? I carried it along because I think it's a question that I'm still curious about.
But your curiosity only leads you to seek to have the judge affirmed. You're not asking to have that judgment expanded so it includes rescission.
No, Your Honor, I'm comfortable with affirmation. But again, as a de novo situation.
Premium has not been refunded.
Premium has not been refunded. The fundamentals at this point is that we offered it as a part of the deck action to refund that subject to court's order. Like I say, I do not believe Judge Lee ordered that. I think he simply said it doesn't fit in the I think he, in one of the later pages, 27 or something, says it doesn't fit in the insuring agreement fundamentally.
Right.
So unless the court has any other questions, I don't have anything else to add. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just for the record, there is no relation.
So okay.
Just
so we're
all right. And Ms. Mulholland, any time remaining? 2 minutes.
Under the policy, there's the exclusion that we discussed about the reasonableness. And I know that he claims that this does not come into play, but the policy does contain the discovery clause, which allows a claim to relate back to a prior year. If you discover it within a latter year. And when we discuss the reasonableness, I think we're talking about an objective standard, a standard of reasonableness that should be decided by the trier of fact. And so whether or not there was any, they reasonably knew of that there could possibly be this claim should have been decided by the trier of fact. So that we would ask that the court overturn the grant of the motion for summary judgment.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
And thanks to both counsel.